Welcome, everybody. Today, we're going to talk about electric school buses, specifically a company called Lion Electric. They're out of Quebec, and they've been building electric school buses and other large format vehicles since 2018. This episode is referencing an electric autonomy article that indicates that the Canadian government and the Atlantic Council, or something like that, as reported by Electric Autonomy Canada, which is a media or a news organization that I find does a very good job of covering the electric vehicle and other space. They don't do just electric vehicles, but they get into green power and distributed energy and all that kind of sort of next steps stuff. Anyways, this article is about a press release that the government of Canada and the Atlantic Council is putting up some for almost $500,000, I think $495,000, to study the feasibility and rollout and so on of electric vehicles. It's a multi-year study that will examine the use of electric vehicles and electric buses specifically, electric school buses, and how they work, how effective they are, the pros, the cons, the possibilities, the negatives, etc. This is not to say that this is a preliminary study before they roll out school buses in Atlantic Canada. In fact, they're already there. Can't say for sure for Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, but I know electric school buses are in use here in New Brunswick, and there are a lot in use in PEI. The partners in this project are Newfoundland and Labrador, which aims to convert 326 school buses to electric. New Brunswick, which aims to convert 1,250 school buses to electric, and Nova Scotia, which aims to transition 1,300 school buses to electric. PEI is way ahead of the game, though. They've already transitioned 107 of their 360 school buses to electric. It has not gone entirely well. It's gone quite well. A lot of the drivers love their electric school buses. But there are some issues and some limitations. It can be challenging. I've read multiple articles, so I'm going to try to combine them together. The Electric Autonomy article didn't get into this, but there's been CBC and other articles about the electric bus experience in PEI. And a lot of it is the bus drivers love to drive them. The students love to ride in them. Everybody's happy about the lack of emissions, students not having to inhale diesel fumes, staff not having to inhale diesel fumes, that kind of thing. But where they're running into some limitations issues is, A, of course, winter range goes down. But this is PEI. It is a very small province. It is an island. They're recognizing that for certain longer runs, in winter, the electric school buses are a bit short, or maybe that they ordered the smaller battery because there's three battery configurations when they should have ordered the larger configuration. They're also recognizing that they need more power points for their electric buses. One of the big pinch points is using electric buses for field trips. If an electric bus has already done its morning pick up the students thing and then has to do a field trip with the students, it may be able to do the field trip, but then it doesn't have enough juice left to do the end of day routes. So that kind of thing can be an issue. So they're learning to continue to use the diesels for those instances, but also that kind of thing can be alleviated by additional charging points. So as an example, right now there is a depot, say, in a centralized area, say like Charlottetown, that will charge up the electric buses. And I'm not saying that is the situation, but here's my thoughts. if they take a road trip to, you know, an hour away, and then have to turn around and come back, that's a 2-hour road trip after doing their morning routes and then having to do, so you're starting to talk the beyond the limit of the battery. But if there was a power point at the destination and the kids spend 3-4 hours at the destination, that bus could be repowering at the destination. It's not that hard. Like right now, the issue is that there are so few public charging points or even privately accessible charging points that these kind of things become issues. If all schools and public places had vehicle charging available, that would make it a lot less problematic, right? Particularly if, you know, destinations like tourist attractions, museums, public buildings had bus charging, that would make a difference too, wouldn't it? Now, we're in early days of this sort of thing, so you're going to see hiccups. And you could say, throw your hands up in the air and say, well, they're just not ready. Well, the buses are ready. The network infrastructure isn't. And as I do this this channel, I've noticed more and more that is the problem. It is the network. The vehicles can do it now, but now we have to build out that network. People seem to think that that can just happen overnight. It can't. The gasoline infrastructure network we have has been built up over the last 100+ years, way more than 100 years, about 100 and almost 200 years now, since the earliest vehicles. That's a long time. And it's been refined and refined and refined to a point where it is fully functional. But we're not there yet with electric. And electric requires more conscious effort and thought to make it work right. We're still going through the issues that we can have and figuring out how to remedy them. And in places like this, we get to talk about it and make that transition. That's not to say that everything is about electric buses is a problem. No. Like I said, they're quieter. They are able to redesign the buses so that they actually have wider bodies, you know, more room inside. There's less moving parts, so there's less breakdowns. That kind of thing is beneficial. But one of the lesser known things is Lion Electric is built into all their vehicles from day one, the ability to do vehicle to grid. What is vehicle to grid? Vehicle to grid is the idea that and I've said this on the channel before, is the idea that your electric vehicle, in this case, a school bus, can provide power to the grid. Now, school buses have been identified as a great power sink for the utility and the grid. Think about it. School buses spend most of their time parked in the depot. Now, if they're parked in the depot and on a charger, they're charging. Apparently takes usually about 5-6 hours to charge up one of these Lion buses from 20% to full on a level 2 charger. Now, that's a heavy duty level 2 charger, it's about 18-19 kilowatts, but it's still a level 2 charger. And they've built into that technology the ability to deliver power to the grid via that charger. So if there is a bunch of electric vehicles, which most of them will not use their entire battery, and if designed to be a backup source of power, will not even use most of their battery, or even a lot of it. They'll be plugged into the grid. If there is a power failure, that is a lot of power that can potentially feed back to the grid. Now, that wouldn't be something that, like, people worry if you have a generator that it would feed power back to the grid, endangering the linesman and all that. No, vehicle-to-grid technology is designed so that the grid can draw on that power. So, A, power outage. but more likely in a case of, oh, there's high demand on the grid right now. We need an extra so many kilowatts, megawatts, whatever. And that's well within the parameters that these buses can deliver for short periods of time. In effect, smoothing the grid so that the buses can pick up these small spikes in the grid without having to turn on peaker plants that would be like fossil fuel or and potentially much larger power generation than is actually required at that time. This electric autonomy article also highlighted the North Rustico Lions Club, which apparently PEI is exploring the vehicle-to-grid concept as an ability to power shelters. Like the Lions Club, this particular Lions Club is identified as a warming cooling shelter in cases of emergency. So that if there's a power failure and you need to bring lots of people to a space, you could use this for community centers and so on. If you set it up right, you can power that building separated from the grid, so it's like a generator. You can power that building via the school buses to keep people warm or cool. Sounds like a great idea. When Electric Autonomy went to PEI to look at this particular Lions Club, they could not find any evidence that had been prepared. It's not like you can just take the giant plug and, you know, plug in the building. That's essentially what will happen, but it needs to be prepared. The plug needs to be there. The grid connection needs to be there. The devices that separate the grid from the building so that, you know, those linesmen don't get injured, those have to be there. That's a like a disconnection device that isolates the building to the battery power as opposed or to the generator power. All that has to be installed and prepared so that when you plug that school bus or several school buses into that building, then you're in a situation where the grid is safe and the people in the building can be kept warm or cool as the needs allow. But they haven't made those preparations yet. So my inclination is that they're identifying this as a potential thing that they could do. Now they have to do some engineering, find some money, and get it, do a trial to see how that would go. It's a technical problem, but it's not a challenging problem. It's an interesting problem. Engineers love this stuff, and it's been done before. They just have to figure out an experience and do it in PEI and eventually New Brunswick, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and everywhere else. Just because something has been done somewhere before doesn't mean it's easy for you to do it where you are. Your place is not so unique that it can't be done. It's that the people in that area have not done it before. So they have to read all the literature, find out how things work and why things work and how to lay it out, and then actually do it a few times to get comfortable with it. So then it becomes a thing. This is one of the major unspoken about advantages of electrification of vehicles. This can be your home. This can be, again, public buildings, emergency situations, disaster relief. Japan used a bunch of Nissan Leafs to power buildings during the Fukushima disaster. That's impressive. They did it on the fly. But, you know, that was always built into the Nissan Leaf as a power thing, right? As I've said, my Hyundai Ioniq 5 is built that way. Now, mine is just a, you know, you plug into the V2G device and you can stick a couple of plugs into or a power bar into it and plug a couple things in. It's only like 15, 16 amps. It's not a lot. It's not going to power my whole house. It could, if they designed it right from the start, where I could get, I could backfeed my house with the correct cable, and, you know, device to isolate the house from the grid, just like a generator. They could have done that, but they didn't. Well, early days. Hey, if you think this information has been valuable to you, do me a favor. Tap that like button and help spread the word to the rest of YouTube. Thanks.
Ford did that with the F-150, but you have to buy a very expensive setup for your house to allow that to happen. It's not inexpensive. It is ridiculously expensive. So a few people that have done it, like Tom Malogny from State of Charge, did do that. So you should check it out. It's well worth the viewing experience to see how that's done. It's a pretty nice piece of business. All right, I'm trying to keep these things a little bit shorter. I do apologize for my trip to, or sorry, I do apologize for missing last week's episode. I did a trip to Halifax, which kind of messed up my whole schedule, and I couldn't get back on track until like midweek. So here it is now. I did manage to do a vehicle charging session at a Petro-Canada station in Halifax. It did not go any better than it did here in Moncton. I think I got up to 85 kilowatts. I will end this episode with a little bit of information from that charging session, just a few clips. It'll only be about a minute or two, and it'll give you an idea of how that session went. Again, these are chargers that are rated for 350 kilowatts. I have a vehicle that should take on, I think it's 250 kilowatts. To charge up. The battery was preconditioned. It was even in a garage overnight, so it was well above zero, like 5 degrees above zero, when I got to the charger. And now it was cold outside, but the battery was warm. It would not have gotten cold in the 5 minutes it took for me to get to the charger. So check that out and see that Petro-Canada is still failing on this particular metric. They need to make sure that the chargers say on the charger and say on the apps what they can actually or actually will deliver as a maximum. Obviously, like a Bolt is not going to get more than 50 kilowatts, but a car that's capable of 250 should, depending on conditions of the car, weather, and whatever, get a lot closer to their max capability than Petro-Canada is delivering. Now, I will invite Petro-Canada to comment on this article or this story yet again, but I don't expect them to respond. They didn't last time. But if they do, I'll have them on the show and they can explain why their network does not work as advertised. Now, it's likely technical difficulties, maybe supply problems, but I'm not going to make excuses or explain for them. They're just not delivering what they're supposed to be delivering, what they claim to deliver. You want to come on the show and tell us how you're going to make that better? Tell us what's going wrong and how you're going to fix it. We're pretty easy going around here. It's a tough new world, but they need to get it right. They have a great opportunity. They have the start of a great network, but they can't keep doing it the way they're doing it. It has to be done right. They have to deliver what they say they're going to deliver. All right, here we are. We're at the Petro-Canada Inn on Old Sambro Road in Halifax, or Herring Cove Road. Herring Cove Road in Halifax. We're going to see how it goes. If you want to have a look, we have 7% in the battery. It is preconditioned. It didn't actually have to. I was in a parking garage all night long. So let's see what happens. All right. It says touch screen to begin. CCS.
Okay.
We're plugged in. It's communicating. Confirm and pay. 50 cents a minute. And it's initiating. It's authorized. Make sure it fully connects. Active power ramping up.
All right, about 4 minutes into the charging exercise, we're at delivering 71 kilowatts. That could be because things are cold. It is -9, as you can see over there. But, yeah, we'll see. I think it's going to go up as we approach, say, 10 or 15 minutes in. I bet it'll start ramping up to its max because we did precondition on the way over. Because I use the navigation to get here, so that will automatically precondition. It was kept in a parking garage overnight, so it should stay reasonably warm. It was a few degrees above 0 Celsius, so that should be pretty good. Maybe it's just getting the battery ready to accept full charge. It is not summer; it's not optimum temperature. At all outside, so that can affect things. We'll see how it goes. Well, we are now at almost 75 kilowatts at about 8 minutes of charging. All right, we're at 89 kilowatts. We're about 25 minutes into the charge. We're almost at 80%. We'll go to 80% and see if we make it any higher. Okay, we're at 80% and we maxed out at 91 kilowatts. 91 kilowatts. That's not ideal. Let's see something here. And if I... Well, for a 350 kilowatt charger, now I think my max... charge rate's 280. Some guy told me recently, but I'll just check. But you know, it's far more than this. With a preconditioned battery, even though it's cold outside, I think I should get closer to this. This is why I wish I had more options than Petro Canada to choose from that has the high powered chargers. Those are coming in. They're supposed to be Electrify Canada chargers coming in this spring, and I think some others. I think Flow is bringing in some of their ultra-fast chargers as well. So we'll have a couple of opportunities, at least by next winter, to do max charging tests on the Ioniq 5 when it's like -9 outside or worse. Anyways, that's it for now. Oh, not quite. Hang on. Let's just give you a look around here. This is the charging station. I'd go outside, but it's a little chilly out there. So it's in a neighborhood. It's at a gas station. So if you look over there, that's a regular gas station with a neighbor's convenience. So it's got all the usual stuff. Pop and coffee and snacks and windshield washer and whatever. There's the gas pumps. And there's the other charger, which is kind of broken at the moment. Ours is working. There's two here. Let's see that over there. Don't know if you can see it. Oh, let's try it over here. How's that? Yeah. I don't know if you can see that, but that is a windshield washing bucket. I'll take it. Bye for now. Well, that's it. Thank you for watching this episode, and we'll see you again in, I think, a week this time. Bye for now.